You are listening to the Innovation Channel, presenting insights from senior executive game changers. This podcast series is brought to you by Cluster, the innovation brokers.
Hello, and welcome to this first ever Cluster Briefing, a new series of podcast interviews created especially for C-level executives. My name is Robert Baldock, and I'm the MD of Cluster. Joining me today is my guest, Richard Warner, the CIO of LV, the maverick, mold-breaking success story of Britain's insurance industry. In 2013, Richard was voted CIO of the Year by the UK IT industry and was ranked number two in a recent top 100 CIO poll. Richard is a passionate advocate of innovation and has led LV to win a succession of global innovation awards. He is, therefore, uniquely qualified to talk on today's hottest topic, innovation. Richard, welcome to this cluster briefing and thank you for taking time out to share your thoughts. Let me start with the most basic question of all. Why bother with innovation? Why rock the boat? Is today's preoccupation with innovation justified, or is it an unhealthy obsession?
Hi, Robin. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak today in your briefing. I think it's a really good question, and probably the most important one. Why bother with innovation? What is the point, I suppose? For me, I guess there are two kind of critical issues. If I look from the technologist's point of view, and as the CIO of an insurance company, actually innovation is vital because in many respects we're a software company that sells insurance. Yeah, at the heart of what we do, we don't manufacture anything physical, we only manufacture an information product. It's therefore really important that we're really good at understanding the role of technology and information in our business. And therefore I think to differentiate in the marketplace, we need to be innovative and more innovative than our competitors, particularly in a world where we have limited resources of people and money to spend. So from the view of the CIO, it's kind of a differentiating factor for us as a business is to be able to innovate effectively with technology. More broadly, I think the reason for driving innovation and trying to create a different way of working is actually more about the responsiveness of the business to the changing business environment in which we live and operate today. I think it's very evident that technology is enabling the cycle of business to move at an ever faster pace. And therefore, it's really important that a business that wants to not only succeed but also survive in some respects needs to be able to operate at a great pace as well. And innovation is a way of kind of inculcating into our people the need to move at greater pace, to take more managed risk, to reduce cycle time around either process, product or business model. And therefore innovation is critical, I think, to the long-term sustainability of our business. Not in of itself, but more because it changes the way we think and operate our business on a day-to-day basis.
So how do you select and prioritise innovation projects? Indeed, what were the first projects you chose to pioneer at LV and why?
I think this is also a critical question. Innovation, if it's kind of set up as an adjunct, as a separate kind of department, I don't think works. Innovation has to be rooted fundamentally in the business agenda. So anything that we choose to do at LV is typically a director level or a C-suite level business problem that we look at, and it's something that we know we want to fix but can't figure out how we would do it with today's tools, techniques, technology, or is something we know we can get to with traditional method but it's probably a couple of years away because it's just down the tracks. It's a bit too far out of reach. And those are the things we prioritise and say, actually, if it fulfils those criteria, if it's got strong business sponsorship from a senior business person, somebody who has a passion for it and believes they need this answered, then it kind of gets to the top of the list. So it's not a scientific kind of process in a way. It's not kind of huge screening exercises. It's actually much more about, we know we've got business problems or business ideas that exist today. We know we've got people who are passionate about them. If we can find that kind of intercept between those things, then we'll put that at the top of the list. And that, if those things persist through the cycle of the innovation, then typically they're successful. If the business problem goes away or if the passion goes away from the sponsor, then we're quite disciplined at trying to kill it quite quickly, actually, because it won't succeed.
So tell us about some of the issues you've encountered. For example, how do you deal with internal politics and risk-averse senior managers?
I think it's a really interesting question. When we first started out on this and I began to kind of talk about the concept of innovation and test and learn, I remember one of my colleagues across the dinner table kind of nearly spat his dinner at me in horror at the concept of test and learn in an insurance business. So there was a kind of interesting in a business that's all about managing risk. There was a real risk aversion to the concept of test and learn, experimentation, and so on and so forth. So we kind of had to change the language a bit, and that's where we kind of came up with our concept of fast track and saying actually it's about solving business problems, but solving them in a different way and using different method. The next wave of objections were then kind of, who's going to pay for this and whatever. So we solved that by saying, well, I'll pay for it by saving money in my budget, and we'll use that as seed funding to get things kicked off. The next objection was then, what's this really going to look like? How are you going to prove it? And so we chose a couple of projects that we thought had a reasonable chance of success, because nothing sells like success. And we got those mobilised quite quickly. We had a broad spectrum of business people involved, and then we made sure that we got senior sponsors in to the wash-ups of those early experiments, and they could see the passion and enthusiasm from their own people who'd been involved, which made them go, actually, there's something in this. This is a different way of achieving outcomes, and therefore we're going to support it, not just because it's delivered a solution, but because it's also delivered kind of a bit of a cultural change in our people and a bit of excitement in our people, which we value. So I guess those were the initial objections. On an ongoing basis, I often describe it as a bit like guerrilla warfare, that we're trying to change the culture bottom up but with top down buy-in by getting people bought into new ways of working. And the biggest blocker is often just it feels uncomfortable. And how do you get people feeling comfortable with a new way of working, with taking risk, with breaking boundaries that have existed for some time? In some respects, that's no different to what we've been doing for decades, which is good old-fashioned kind of change management and culture change. I just think we have to do it more and more quickly now than we've had to in the past.
So how much of your innovation work is delivered by internal IT teams, and how much do you rely on outside firms? What's the perfect balance, and how do you go about selecting innovation partners?
Again, a good question. So a lot of the innovation work, we do use internal people for a lot of it, because actually they've got to understand the nature of the business, kind of the policies and process we operate to. The culture in particular is important. But we do use external companies a lot, either technology companies who can bring in a particular product and then help us innovate around it, or sometimes companies can bring in and facilitate an idea. So they may be people who kind of bring a different lens on how do you develop an insight into the customer, or how do you develop an insight into marketing, or so on and so forth. Because actually you just want people to provoke the art of the possible in the minds of our guys. And actually if I can combine kind of that strong LV knowledge and customer passion with an external here's the art of the possible, you can often create some quite remarkable outcomes. In terms of selecting them, it kind of is driven by the business problem we're trying to solve. So we come back to what's the problem I'm trying to solve, therefore what's the field of opportunity out there of things or partners who might suit that. That often is quite hard, because actually in this day and age there are thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of startups and small companies out there offering a whole range of services, and therefore it's quite important to have a network into kind of the world of technology, but also into the world of people who think differently, to enable us to say actually how would we kind of tap into the right sectors, the right companies. So we do some of that through our own network internally. We do that with some of our core suppliers, but importantly we also use people like Cluster, I guess, who kind of help us connect and talk to different companies that we wouldn't have knowledge of otherwise. So it's very important to have that broad network, I think, and constantly be scanning and saying, who can bring me new ideas, new insight?
So let's look more closely at a specific innovation project. Could you tell us more about one particular project, its technical challenges, the solutions, and the part that external niche firms played in delivering your innovation agenda?
So I think a good pertinent example right now would be the changes we're making in the wake of the pension liberation regulation changes that have been announced by the Chancellor last year. The brief potted history is that in April last year, George Osborne said, nobody will ever need to buy an annuity again, which was a real bolt out of the blue for the life insurance and pensions industry. Nobody saw it coming. You could either sit there and wring your hands in the light of the pension changes, or you could see this as an opportunity. And we saw it as the latter because we felt we had a strong customer service proposition. We had some unique products and a unique product blend. And we were also a challenger brand in the market. And we felt this was a good opportunity for us to try and take market share and be seen to be different. Now, that's easy to say. Actually, we were then living in a very uncertain world because post the announcement from George Osborne, there was very little policy detail that sat behind it in the first few months. And so the meat on the bones had to be fleshed out. And at the same time, we had to be thinking about, OK, well, what services and propositions are we going to offer to the market next April when this all comes live, against a backdrop of not exactly knowing what the regulations were going to be. So it was kind of a existential moment in a way for our business. You know, actually, how do you change the direction of the business and the shape and nature of a business in less than 12 months against an uncertain backdrop and turn that into an opportunity in which you can succeed? So our conclusion was, well, we need to do some different stuff. We need to build on our strengths. We need to build what we called a blended product offering. And we need to figure out a way of getting it out to the IFA community quickly and effectively and helping them help their customers and therefore ultimately our customers make difficult choices. So we kicked off a project, but we were faced with, as I say, a kind of difficult landscape because we didn't know all the things that the regulation would demand. We hadn't done anything like this before. We were dealing with quite legacy technology, and the team who were tasked with delivering this had a tough couple of years of quite troubled deliveries. So we needed to do something quite different. Both in terms of the design and principles behind what we delivered, but also the way we delivered it and the kind of risk level we were prepared to take. So we decided that this felt like a perfect territory for an agile project, not something this particular team had done before. We felt this was therefore something we were going to need some help with. So we said, OK, well, who can help us deliver this project, but deliver it in a way that is sustainable for our business, because there's no point in handing the keys over to somebody and saying, go build this thing for us, because we don't know what we're building. We also don't want to kind of have it removed from the front line of the business because it's such a fast-changing regulatory environment. We need the team sitting with the business people as they interpret the regulations and as they interpret the business needs coming back from the IFAs. So with the help of Cluster, we looked around in the market to try and identify a company who could help us not just with the technical expertise, but also with the, if you like, the cultural fit to help our people really grow in confidence and stature in building something quite technically complex in quite a short period of time. And effectively what we did, we ran a very high-speed agile project over about 4 or 5 months, where we went from a standing start to delivering fundamentally new capability for our business and for our IFA customers through a whole series of agile sprints. And we've delivered, we believe, we've kind of gone from probably being a couple of steps behind the market to a couple of steps ahead in terms of the tool set we've now been able to deliver. For me, that's been fantastic, not just because of the outcome of what we've delivered, but actually, if I walk around that office now with that business team and that technology team, they walk a foot taller. They're very proud of what they've achieved, at the pace they've achieved it. These are guys who've been involved in technology for 20 years who are kind of reborn again and have found a real passion again for the technology and an excitement for the technology because they work with a company who's brought real in-depth expertise and insights to them. So I think it's a great success story for us because it's not just about the outcome, it's about the culture change and the passion it's invoked within the organisation.
I now want to ask you a very leading question. There's an old saying that we learn more in life from our mistakes than we do from our successes. What innovation failures have you had? How did you cope with them? And what lessons have they taught you for the future?
Well, that's always a good question. I think there's a few things here. One is, in our innovation process, our fast-track process, we are quite disciplined about saying if it doesn't work, we'll kill it and kill it quickly because we don't want to spend time on something that hasn't got legs, hasn't got support, hasn't got sponsorship. I guess more broadly, the thing, if I reflect on the last 2 or 3 years, that I've learnt is there's a big chunk of this is about timing. It's really vital to have the business stakeholder support. And some of that, when you're pushing something that's a little bit outside of their comfort zone, comes down to, are they ready for it? Can they cope with it? In terms of if they've already got a fairly packed agenda, as any senior executive does have, you've got to make sure that the thing you're pushing is of relevance to them at that point in time. So my failures have tended to be where I've got enthusiastic about something that, yeah, my level of enthusiasm outweighs theirs, and I've tended to push it probably longer than I should have done. And I guess that's a good lesson learned for me, is, you know, you've kind of got to try and find that match of tempo between, yeah, the business demand and, you know, your enthusiasm, your own ideas that you're bringing to the table. Having said that, I think as a CIO or as any executive in a business, you have a responsibility to bring the disruption, bring the push, bring the challenge all the time. But it is, you're always kind of course correct to try and make sure you've got the right balance in there. I think lessons for the future is you need to be reasonably resilient about this stuff. It's quite interesting. I look at a number of experiments we tried 2-3 years ago now, which at the time didn't get traction. A number of them are coming back. Yeah, because again, they're all of their time. People are now going, actually, that would be quite interesting. And also to be patient. You know, these things sometimes take longer than you anticipate, and that can be frustrating. But you know, you just need to, you know, bide your time sometimes and let the momentum build.
There are a lot of senior managers, especially CIOs and CTOs, who share your passion for innovation. What advice would you offer to someone embarking on an innovation program? What are the all-important do's and don'ts for success?
I think a lot of this depends on the individual context of your organisation, but I think the critical thing for me where we've been most successful is always rooting it in solving a business problem, and typically always rooting it in solving a business problem that's got reasonably senior engagement, or is a broad-based issue that impacts a lot of people in the business. But either way, it's got to have, you've got to have a purpose. If you've got a purpose, you know, we often say people are often at their best in a crisis. I think it's not just a crisis. Crisis is another manifestation of passion. So you've got to have passion. There's got to be somebody there who sees that problem and wants it solved and is, you know, passionate about it happening and about its success. So that one is probably the critical golden rule, if you like, for me. It's got to be a real business problem with real business engagement and sponsorship. And you've got to be, therefore, the flip side of that is you've got to be prepared to kind of kill things that don't have that support. And yeah, even if you are a passionate believer in them yourself, if there isn't that sufficient engagement from your colleagues who are the recipients, if you like, of that innovation or that business problem, then you've got to let it go. As I said earlier, I think you've got to be a bit resilient at times and push through a few things, be prepared to knock a few doors down because sometimes there are blockers. And you've got to be patient because sometimes these things take longer than you think. We've got a good example at the moment around big data and a particular approach we're taking to it. And it's probably taken 12 months, but in the last few weeks I've just suddenly seen a real kind of wave of people, if you like, getting it and going, actually, we do need to do this and we need to do it differently. And that's great. And they now own it and they've got the passion for it, and that's great. And so my success in that space is much more about seeing them own it and be passionate about it, and that's great. If I'd pushed it too hard 6 months ago, it probably would be another year before it took off. So yeah, learning patience and resilience is a key skill, I guess.
Richard, thank you for those thoughts. It's been a fascinating insight into innovation, and thank you for joining me on this, our first Cluster Briefing. I look forward to welcoming you to future Cluster Briefings. But for now, thank you and keep innovating.
If you would like even more insights, we have prepared a special point of view paper on the whole subject of innovation. For your free copy, simply visit cluster.net. That's CLUSTRE.net. And click on Innovation Channel. You can also browse our website to find out more about Cluster, the innovation brokers.